the Honorable Judges of the United States Court of Appeals in and for the Seventh Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this Honorable Court are admonished to draw near and give their attention, as the Court is now sitting. God save the United States and this Honorable Court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The first case for argument is Yindy versus CCH. Mr. Madden.
Good morning, Your Honor. Counsel. May it please the Court. A convincing mosaic of circumstantial evidence has been defined by the Court to include various elements of suspicious timing, ambiguous statements, ambiguous behavior, pretextual nature of the discharge, and other bits and pieces of illuminating evidence. By its very nature, circumstantial evidence cannot lead inexorably to anything.
Does it really make any difference that the district court used the term inexorable, given the fact that our review is de novo from a summary judgment ruling? I mean, we'll look anyway at what was presented.
You will, and I hope that you do, because I think that when you do, you will see that a convincing mosaic of circumstantial evidence is presented. I think the fact that the district court has raised that standard by insisting on inexorable evidence highlights the error that it made, and so I use it to illustrate that I hope that this court does not make that same determination, that the facts and circumstances presented by the plaintiff must compel a conclusion under the direct method or indirect method of based on circumstantial evidence, rather than merely permit a reasonable inference that retaliation was the motivating factor.
Now, are you going to stress the retaliation claim? Because I had more trouble following your argument on the disability claim than I did the retaliation claim. I certainly don't disagree that reproduction could be a major life, you know, activity, but I don't see any link between that activity and her problems on the job. What I do see is, at least it appears to me in your brief, you're stressing the retaliation point.
We do stress the retaliation. As you know, the plaintiff in her search for a resolution to the issues filed a number of EEOC charges, and I think the general tenor of the case is one of retaliation. From the time that she complains of not being able to receive the merit promotion and the merit raise is given to her coworker.
Don't employers prefer infertile employees?
I would suppose that they do, Judge.
Less time off. I don't understand how there would be employment discrimination against someone just because she couldn't have kids.
Well, I think it goes beyond simply being infertile. There were associated illnesses and conditions that Ms. Yindy had that related to
that. I understand illness. Yes, I understand illness. But I don't understand why just the condition of being infertile would lead to employment discrimination. Other forms of discrimination, maybe, but why employment? So shouldn't we forget about that and just focus on the vertigo, really. Isn't that her?
The intermittent idiopathic vertigo. I'm sorry, Judge.
Isn't it the vertigo that interfered with her working?
It really is the vertigo, the dizziness, the headaches, the...
Well, wait a minute. Vertigo is dizziness, right? I don't understand. What's the difference?
Well, one's perhaps just the medical term, the other's the lay term. I don't know that there is a big distinction.
Is there any distinction?
Between vertigo and dizziness?
Right.
I think they're probably synonymous for our purposes. The point that I was making with the illustration of her medical condition, Judge, is that the vertigo is idiopathic. They don't know what caused it. She first presented with the symptoms of vertigo in 2000. That led to the cancer diagnosis and the cancer treatment. And so the vertigo still persists as she continues to deal with the repercussions of having the endometrial carcinoma. So I think it's an associated...
Well, it doesn't matter what the source of the vertigo was. If the vertigo is the condition that interferes with her work, who cares where it came from?
Well, in this case, Judge, I mean, we have an analysis of whether or not she is a qualified individual with a disability. to the extent that...
Well, the question is, is the vertigo sufficiently persistent to constitute a disability, and does it, you know, interfere substantially with her working, or with some other, well, I don't know, what is the major life activity that the vertigo interferes with?
Well, she testified that she had, and this was part of the reason that she needed the telecommuting, was that she had problems with concentration, with seeing, obviously, the dizziness and associated.
Yeah, but in terms of the language of the statute, what is the major life activity that you're contending her disability prevents her from doing?
Well, again, because we primarily view the vertigo as part of the symptomatology of the carcinoma.
This is all mush. I'm asking you a simple question. What is the major life activity with which her vertigo interferes? You know the expression, major life activity?
I do, Judge. In reproduction, first of all, reproduction, you know.
But that's irrelevant, right?
I disagree that it's irrelevant, because the vertigo is attached to the endometrial carcinoma. It's part of the symptomatology that makes up that disease that she hasn't been completely cured of. Again, her entire medical issue started with the vertigo. That's what led to the diagnosis of the cancer, and that's never subsided since then. So we think it's interrelated. So the major life activity would be reproduction. It's associated with the problems of reproduction. In addition to that, she does have other issues.
You say it hasn't subsided, but I thought she's driving now.
I believe the record in her deposition, she said that in her new job, she does drive.
Drives. All right. So what is it that the vertigo is interfering with? I don't understand.
Well, I should back up, Judge. When she testified that she was driving, and this is in 2005 now, this is 2 years after her discharge. So at the time of her discharge and the time of the period of 2002, she still is having trouble.
Yes, but do you have some theory as to how long a disability has to last in order to be a disability? I mean, suppose someone breaks his leg and can't work for a month, and his employer fires them. Is that a violation of the Disabilities Act?
No, I think the case law makes clear that you have to take into consideration the anticipated prognosis of the condition. When is it likely to get better?
The statute said it has to be more than a year. You're in your rebuttal time, but I want to just leave the question with you. You can either answer it now or later. On the retaliation claim, I want to get to the essence of whether you are just asking us to assume that she was doing a better job than her employer thought she was doing, or whether there is, in fact, a jury issue that the employer's statement that she wasn't living up to the performance plan and the like was pretextual, or how do you get beyond the fact that we don't sit around and just make employment decisions ourselves?
Yeah, I believe there's absolutely a jury question there, because in the PIP there were exactly four deliverables that she was supposed to match. She had a 30-day window and four deliverables to make. As we set out in the brief, she met all of those deliverables. Her supervisor then creates another issue and says that it violates the PIP. So I think we can look exactly to the language of the PIP, look exactly to the testimony of Zarinka Allen, the human resource manager, that said she, in fact, was meeting all her deliverables, and they did not give her the 30 days to show that his reason is protectional. I think that's a jury question, Judge.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Ms. Albrecht?
Good morning. Good morning, counsel. May it please the court. Counsel indicated with regard to the question as to what major life function was impaired that the circumstance was this intermittent idiopathic vertigo. He mentioned, though, that the idiopathic vertigo had persisted since the time of her first diagnosis. There is no evidence of that, and there's certainly no evidence that anybody at his employer, CCH, knew that.
Ms. Albrecht, I wonder if you can come back to the disability if you want to, but I really have some questions about the retaliation claim, because it seems to me that on this record, one can see that up until the time Ms. Yindy filed her first complaint, she was getting very positive reviews. Her 2001 performance review was positive. She was especially praised for things that she was criticized for in the PIP. And there is this oddness that the PIP requires her to consult with her supervisors, and yet she's fired the day after she says something. So it's not to say that there aren't reasons you could put forth that might justify that. It's the question really is, why isn't there a jury issue on the bona fides of CCH's rationale here?
Well, in the first instance, the record is not devoid of any evidence of performance issues before she filed her EEOC charge. In fact, she was taken off of the telecommuting program that they permitted her to do voluntarily because of performance issues, and she was told that that's why she was being removed from the program.
But that was after, as I recall, she had complained about not getting a promotion, right?
She complained about not getting a promotion after she was taken off the telecommuting program, where she filed a grievance, and it was then that she complained about not getting the promotion.
Said a word to her about any performance issues at that point. Maybe it was sitting around in Mr. Tennant's mind, but I don't see any record of this.
Well, the fact of the matter was that the evidence showed that while she was, and it's in the record, it certainly isn't highlighted, Mr. Tennant did have concerns about her performance.
But if he never tells her anything and her performance reviews are positive, maybe the company's lying to her that it thinks she's doing a great job. I don't know. It's a contradictory set of messages from the company in this record.
Well, the problem was that during the period she was on, and starting with the telecommuting period, she certainly had problems performing the duties of her job. One glaring fact that isn't disputed at all is that the testimony of Mr. Tennant and his boss testified that they observed mouse movement on her computer, and she spent all day on her computer, observed mouse movement only periodically and simply to keep the screen up at her home. They were able to view that from the office. They thought that she was not working. And in fact, she testified that she was fully able to work 8-hour days, perform the duties of her job, but now on appeal we're finding out that she was tired, that there were other issues that were preventing her from performing.
But the record showed that there was an expectation of a certain number of hours a day on the computer, and that she was meeting that expectation, that she was on the computer that long.
Well,
again, I'm not saying that there isn't anything that the company could say on the other side of this, but we have to take the facts favorably to her at this stage.
Understood, except that it depends on what you are considering to be on the computer. If you're talking about having the computer on and occasionally moving the mouse, then the computer was on.
You didn't argue that this fact at all in your brief. You didn't say anything about mouse movement.
Oh, it's certainly referred to...
It's not in your brief.
After being taken off the telecommuting program on July 1st and being told that the reasons were because of her work performance, she filed her grievance. In early August, she was again counseled that her performance had continued to slip and that she needed to start getting projects done. On August 15th, she files a written grievance following up on her oral grievance, and neither the July 1st grievance nor the written grievance that she filed on August 18th said anything about discrimination. On September 6th, she met...
And of course, at this point, though, what we're concerned about is retaliation for filing these grievances, right?
Right, but the argument seems to be, how come they never put her on a PIP until after she filed a charge of discrimination?
Why does the PIP have such an odd failure to correspond to the record of what she had done before?
Well, the record of what she had done before is that she was taken off of the telecommuting program because of performance deficiencies. She was counseled about performance deficiencies in early August.
But the performance deficiencies that you just described for the reasons taking her off the telecommuting program are failure to work enough And the PIP isn't talking about that. The PIP is talking about particular areas where her job performance needs improvement.
Well, one of the areas that she needed improvement in was completing projects on time. She was certainly counseled about that in August. And to address a question that you raised earlier, Your Honor, just to make sure that it doesn't get lost. The PIP advised Ms. Yindy that she needed to correct in four areas. And one of those areas was problem solving. And one of the problem solving areas was being able to think independently and to use her judgment appropriately. The record does show that in one of the respects that she failed to exercise poor judgment or exercise proper judgment was in calling up the software company every time she encountered a problem. That was a recurring problem with her. And when she's on the PIP and she gets this, she sends an email to her boss about a problem she's experiencing with a program, he asks her boss, Ken Tennant, asks her to explain the problem, and that was yet another example where she had made a mistake, exercised poor judgment, and not demonstrated that she could problem solve. In fact, before the issue was apparent to him as to whether or not she'd again made another mistake, he said to her, I'm going to meet with you tomorrow in the first of weekly meetings.
Bi-weekly, yeah.
The charge wasn't filed until the week or the days between September 13th and September 17th. Ms. Yindy was, in fact, counseled several times, July 1st, early August, and on September 6th of 2002, at which time Ms. Allen met with Ms. Yindy to discuss Mr. Tennant's response to her grievance. And the response to the grievance was that her performance was deficient. It's a detailed response to her performance issues. The convincing mosaic standard that the court requires for retaliation isn't the standard of permissive inferences.
Let's purge convincing mosaic from the legal lexicon.
Well, certainly it goes beyond being a permissive. Permissive.
See, a court, a judge, or uses a phrase, and immediately people start talking about a new legal standard.
The court has articulated in many ways.
Mean anything convincing mosaic? What's that about?
Well, it needs to be convincing, not simply permissive.
Yeah, you need to have convincing evidence, right?
Permissive.
You need a mosaic.
Well, and a permissive inference is what the first stage of the McDonnell-Douglas test is, after which there's a dialogue. The mosaic, the quantum of evidence, of circumstantial evidence, needs to be more than something that's possible. Briefly, in closing, with respect to the ADA claim, the only condition of which CCH was made aware was idiopathic intermittent vertigo, some dizziness that was unexplained. The only restriction that her doctor advised was that she not drive. She wasn't required to drive in her job. Nevertheless, she was permitted to telecommute for a period of time. There's simply no evidence that after she stopped telecommuting, that she didn't drive to work.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Albrecht. Mr. Madden, how much time does he have? 2 minutes?
Promise to be brief, Judge. a couple points I want to make quickly, and it's the one critical fact
Is it your contention that before she filed her first complaint, her first grievance, there had been no issues concerning the adequacy of her performance?
Yes. There had been no issues from the period of January to July 1st. There was no issue of the adequacy of performance. She's telecommuting for the first 3 weeks on a full-time basis. Then from basically April to July, she's doing it on a part-time basis. She sees Ken Tennant in the office on 2 days a week, I think is the idea. He never once mentions to her at any time in that period any problem with her performance deficiencies or any problem with her log-on activity or anything of that nature. So July 1st is the first time he ever says to her, you're not logging on enough, and then there's some other performance issue. And what's interesting is beyond that, from July 1st through August 21st, when she actually gets the formal written grievance filed, and I want your honors, ask your honors to pay attention to the obstruction that she had in that period from July 1 to August 21 to actually get the grievance considered. There's still no mention at any time of a performance improvement plan. And even when they set the meeting of, she has one meeting with Zrinka Allen in September 6th, no discussion of possibly being on a performance improvement plan. So whatever performance deficiency there was, it certainly wasn't enough to be performance-related discipline or put her on a PIP. And most importantly, which the district court also overlooked, September 26th, Zrinka Allen testified that the purpose of that meeting was simply to talk about a grievance, which was the EEO grievance through the company. It was not supposed to be performance or disciplinary related at all. She testified very clearly to that. She had never had any discussion with Ken Tennant before that meeting about a PIP. They confront Ms. Yindy about her EEOC charge in that meeting. And it's in that meeting that Ken Tennant says that she's insubordinate, and it's in that meeting that he first announces that she's going to be put on a PIP and subject to discharge. And that is a critical piece of evidence which we'd ask your honors to consider, which the district court did not, and we'd ask that your honors reverse the grant of summary judgment. We thank you for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Madden. Thank you to both.